Welcome and thank you for standing by. I would like to remind all participants that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If anyone needs assistance, you must press star zero. Thank you, and Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Thank you, everybody, and welcome to the April Charm Telecon. Today, we're lucky to have Tony DelGenio from the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He's going to be talking about Saturn weather forecast, hazy, windy, with a chance of storms. Here's a little bit of information about Tony. He received his PhD in 1978 from UCLA, and he's been at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies ever since. He's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University, Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. His research interests include comparative dynamics of planetary atmospheres and the role of clouds and convection in terrestrial climate change. He's a member of our Cassini ISS team. That's the imaging team. He also has worked on the Pioneer Venus TRMM/GPM, CloudSat, Calypso, and Terra Aqua missions. He's the editor of the Journal of Climate, an AMS fellow in 2007, and received the NASA Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal in 2008. Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I think with all that, I'll let you take this presentation and get started.
Okay, thank you everyone for being here today. And I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about the circulation of Saturn's atmosphere and what are the major questions we have about it and what we've been learning from Cassini. And if you're looking at my presentation right there on the cover slide, you can see one of our more recent images of Saturn. That was just taken back in February with a really beautiful view of the northern hemisphere, which is only starting to become very well illuminated as we move towards spring. Most of the mission so far, we've been looking at the southern hemisphere, and I'll show you that the two hemispheres are quite different, and the northern hemisphere is a lot nicer to be doing business with. But that's mainly just for show for right now, just to have a pretty picture to begin. If you move to the first real slide, slide number two, I'll try to tell you what we're going to be talking about today. I'd like to try to motivate this talk in general from a what we call a comparative planetology standpoint, and that is trying to understand where Saturn fits in among all of the other planets with atmospheres in the solar system. Some direct comparisons between Saturn and Jupiter, ways in which they're similar, ways in which they're different, and because we have one particular planet that we know more about than any of the others, the Earth, what about our knowledge of Earth might be relevant to our attempts to understand Saturn. Mostly I'm going to be concentrating on global issues about Saturn's dynamics, why there's the banded cloud structure that I'm sure you're all familiar with on the Jovian planets, why are there these alternating eastward and westward jets that we see on the Jovian planets. And then at the end, though, I'll focus on a couple of regional topics of interest, namely the equatorial jet and how it's been changing over time and the south polar vortex where we've been seeing some interesting things going on. All right, if we can move to the third slide, then. This is, don't be put off by the complexity of that diagram. You don't really need to understand much in it. Just note that this is basically a classification of all of the planetary atmospheres. Well, I don't have Uranus and Neptune on. This is a paper from 1995, and we weren't quite sure where to put them yet. But for six of the planets with atmospheres, this is an attempt to classify them according to what are the important things that determine what kind of circulation they have. And so on the x-axis, we have something called the Richardson number, which essentially tells you whether the atmosphere in the vertical direction is more stable or less stable. The larger values of that, the more stable the atmosphere is, the harder it is to move things vertically, the lower the values, the less stable, the easier it is for air to move vertically. And on the y-axis, we have the rotation rate of the planet, or rotation period of the planet. So small values indicate rapid rotation, and large values indicate slow rotation. Rotation rate essentially tells you how easy it is for fluid parcels to move latitudinally on a planet. The more rapid the rotation rate, the harder it is to move in latitude. The weaker the rotation rate, the easier it is to move in latitude. And those two things become significant because weather circulations in planetary atmospheres are there primarily for one reason, and that is to move heat from places where there's too much of it to other places on the planet where there's too little of it. And so we can sort of classify the different planetary atmospheres according to these two parameters. Basically, in the upper right-hand corner of the diagram, Venus and Titan are most slowly rotating planets. Those are planets that actually are very stable in the vertical direction, so it's easy to move things horizontally, not very easy to move things vertically. And those planets have circulations that primarily are trying to accomplish the poleward transport of heat from the equator to the higher latitudes. The terrestrial planets in the lower right-hand side of that diagram, Earth and Mars, have they're sort of an in-between regime in which they try to accomplish both a vertical transport and a poleward transport of heat. And that's accomplished mainly by what we call baroclinic storms, but what you will know as the low and high pressure centers that you'll see on a typical weather map of the United States. And then the Jovian planets are down in the lower left-hand corner. Because they rapidly rotate, it's very difficult for those planets to move things in the latitudinal direction between equator and pole, and so the excursions of the atmosphere and latitude are relatively limited. But because these planets are internally heated, they have lots of heat to try to get out from their interior, and they're very weakly stratified, we say. It's very easy for fluid to move in the vertical direction, and so we believe that the weather, the circulation on the Jovian planets, is mainly trying to move the heat upward, and that's what distinguishes them from the other planets in the solar system. Okay, let's move on to the fourth slide. Another slightly different angle on comparative planetology, and that is how easy or difficult it is to actually learn something about particular planets from observations. And as someone who does Earth science part of the time, I get spoiled a little bit because the Earth is actually one of the easiest places to observe for a variety of reasons, and Saturn is at the other end of the spectrum. It's one of the most difficult planets to observe, and here are the reasons why. The Earth is partly covered by clouds, but it's partly clear, and so with remote sensing instruments, we can see the tops of the clouds, and the clouds are at different levels, and so sometimes we can see the upper troposphere, sometimes we can see the lower troposphere. Where it's clear, we can see all the way down to the ground, so it's very easy with remote sensing to observe all of the different parts of the atmosphere that we would like to observe. Saturn and the other Jovian planets are just about completely overcast, and that's a big problem for us because most of our remote sensing is seeing either near the tops of the clouds or the clearer air that is above the tops of the clouds, but the meteorology is being driven down beneath that we can't easily observe with our remote sensing instruments, and so we have to be a little bit clever and use what we can see at the top to try to infer what's going on down at the bottom, and that's a big limitation. Another thing about Earth is that it's a small planet, and once you start to try to observe Saturn, which is an order of magnitude bigger, and develop a remote sensing strategy, you learn right away how difficult it is. With Earth satellites, you can easily observe the entire Earth with one satellite if you just wait long enough for it to go around enough times. But for Saturn, you need to stay far away to see any reasonable fraction of it, and even then you can't really capture the whole planet in your field of view at distances that are reasonable to resolve the features that you want. And so you need a more complex strategy of producing mosaics of images that observe a particular part of the planet at once and then try over time to build up a lot of observations. Earth is a planet that does not have rings. Saturn, as we all know, has lots of beautiful rings, and of course one person's signal is another person's noise. A lot of the science that's being done on Cassini is involved in trying to understand what's going on with the rings, but as an atmospheric scientist, the rings just get in my way, prevent me from seeing Saturn because they directly obscure the view, and they cast shadows that prevent me from seeing other parts of Saturn. A more important thing that perhaps many people might not have thought about is that the Earth is in the inner solar system, a lot closer to the Sun, and so it's strongly heated by the Sun, which means that the weather processes of interest, the storms, the low and high pressure centers, thunderstorms, and things like that on Earth, that are the primary agents by which heat is moved around in the atmosphere, are happening all the time. At any given time, you can just look at a weather map of the United States and see low and high pressure centers. In some place in the United States, there's going to be thunderstorms happening on most days. And so you don't have to observe the Earth for that long a time period in order to see the things that you need to see. Saturn's very different. It's far away from the Sun, weakly heated. It's got an internal heat source, but that actually is fairly weak too. And because it's very cold, it doesn't heat, and very deep atmosphere, it doesn't heat up and cool down very quickly. So everything happens slowly on the Jovian planets, and that means you have to observe them for a long time in order to see things change. The other thing about Saturn is that it doesn't have a solid surface. On Earth, storms come and go, and they go partially because there's friction at the bottom boundary to help the storms die out. But on Saturn, there is no solid surface at the bottom to make the storms die out. And so once something occurs, it sort of just kind of stays there for a while, and you don't get to watch it change. And by watching things change, that's how we learn what's going on. And some of the more important things that we care about, like thunderstorms, happen only once in a while. On Earth, again, thunderstorms are happening all the time. On Saturn, a little burp every once in a while helps to clear the stomach of Saturn, and you have to wait a long time before you see the next one. So that means we've got to spend a lot of time observing Saturn to really understand what's going on. And then finally, the one obvious thing that makes a difference is that we do have people on Earth who launch weather balloons to sample the atmosphere directly so that we have a good idea how to interpret our remote sensing observations. And on Saturn, unfortunately, we don't have that, and so remote sensing is all we have, and we have to always be trying to figure out whether our interpretations of the remote sensing data are valid or not. Okay, let's go on to the next slide, slide number 5. This is just a comparison of the vertical structure of Jupiter and Saturn, and qualitatively, Jupiter and Saturn are very similar. They both have a temperature profile that is about as steep as it's allowed to be in the deep atmosphere, where we believe convection is going on, driven by the internal heating inside both planets' atmospheres, and then the temperature decreases up to a tropopause that is at a pressure level of about 100 millibars or so, and then increases above that in the stratosphere. And that's qualitatively similar to the Earth's atmosphere as well. Saturn and Jupiter also are both believed to have three different cloud layers: an upper-level ammonia cloud layer, a mid-level ammonium hydrosulfide layer, and then a deeper water cloud layer that's the hardest to observe because the other higher cloud layers get in the way most of the time. But every once in a while, some of the water leaks its way up to the top in thunderstorms and things like that, and so we can tell directly that there's a significant amount of water underneath. The two big differences in Saturn and Jupiter are that Saturn, being farther from the Sun, is colder than Jupiter is, and that means that the water forms at a deeper level, which makes it harder for us to see processes going on that have to do with water, with the generation of thunderstorms and so on, and I'll comment on that a little bit more later. The other thing about Saturn is that although both Saturn and Jupiter have a layer of haze, aerosol particles above the main ammonia ice cloud deck, Saturn's haze is much thicker than Jupiter's haze is, and that also makes it harder to see through down to the clouds that we want to observe where the winds are blowing that we would like to understand. So if you then go to slide number 6, this shows you global mosaics of images of Jupiter and Saturn, and the consequence of that tropospheric haze that's so much thicker on Saturn than on Jupiter is that on Jupiter we can see lots more detail in our images, whereas Saturn is very washed out and pale by comparison. And that means that our job in trying to observe the circulation of the atmosphere is that much more difficult. The primary way that we observe the atmosphere on the imaging team is to pick out individual cloud features whose morphology, whose shape, and color and size we can recognize, and to try to track their motions from one image to another image that might have been taken, let's say, one Saturn rotation later than this one. And you have to be able to identify cloud features in order to track their motions. And on Jupiter, it's very easy to do that. You can see that there are lots of things that you can track. On Saturn, there are relatively few things that you can track. And so just to give you an idea of the consequences, Voyager flew past both Jupiter and Saturn a couple of decades ago, and in about the same time period flying past both planets, we got about 10 times as much wind data for Jupiter as we did for Saturn. So Saturn is a tough nut to crack. And the way we approach observing Saturn in Cassini is that, first of all, we try to take most of our images not at visible wavelengths, but at near-infrared, longer wavelengths. And the reason that you do that is that the longer the wavelength you go to, the less the small haze particles overlying the main clouds get in your way. You can kind of see through them a little bit better as you go to longer and longer wavelengths. Essentially, once the wavelength of the radiation is comparable to or greater than the size of the particles, you can begin to see through them a little bit better. So we get greater image contrasts when we look at those longer wavelengths. And then the other thing we do, and this is the beauty of having an orbiter rather than a flyby mission, is that we try to image Saturn over and over and over again to build up the statistics that we need to really determine what's going on with the circulation. All right, let's move on to slide number 7. This is just a monochromatic. This is one of our near-infrared filters that we're using. That's why it's a black and white image, not a color image. And this is a mosaic, actually, of images that we have put together at one particular time, showing you parts of the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere simultaneously. This was last year. So the North Pole is near the upper boundary there, and the South Pole near the lower boundary, and you can see the equator and the ring plane right in the middle, and the shadow of the rings just above it obscuring part of the atmosphere. But the reason I'm showing you this is that now that we're starting to see the northern hemisphere of Saturn in the last year or so, you can notice that it's very different in appearance from the southern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere is extremely hazy, low contrast, and by the way, it's summer still in the southern hemisphere, although we're approaching spring equinox, but in the summer, apparently, the summer hemisphere, the haze thickens up and it makes it very difficult to see features, whereas in the northern hemisphere, we can see much better and the contrasts are much greater. And so, fortunately for us, we had some very long observing sequences in 2007 that gave us views of the northern hemisphere, and we're just starting to process those now. And we think that we're going to get probably 10 times as much information from that data set as we've gotten all the way up to this point from our southern hemisphere imaging. Okay, let's go on to slide number 8. Here's another pretty picture, color picture of Saturn, and showing you the wind profiles, the wind in the what we call the zonal direction, the eastward-westward direction, as a function of latitude. And on the bottom is a profile that we published a couple of years ago from early Cassini orbits, showing how the winds vary with latitude. And in the upper panel is one that we just put together in the last few months from our first northern hemisphere images, showing you something similar. And I'm not going to go through the details of what all those different color symbols are right now, but we'll come back to that later. For now, I just wanted to show you this figure to illustrate, in case you weren't aware, that Saturn, like Jupiter, has a series of alternating jets, that is, maxima in the wind speed, and some of them go toward the east and some of them go toward the west, and they go back and forth like that with tremendous wind shear, change in wind as you move from one latitude to another latitude, and that is very much like Jupiter. And the wind speeds are quite high. They're generally of order something like 225 miles per hour at their peak, and except for the equatorial region, equatorward of about, let's say, 15 degrees latitude in each hemisphere, outside that region, the jets seem to be remarkably stable for periods of decades. The winds are about the same now as they were at the time of Voyager And that's one of the interesting things that we want to understand. The only exception to that is, as you can see in the equatorial region, there is this huge equatorial jet that blows toward the east at speeds of about 800 miles per hour. So we're interested in understanding why the Jovian planets have these alternating eastward and westward jets, and why are they so stable? Why don't they change from decade to decade very much, except in the equatorial region? All right, let's go on then to the next slide. This shows you a little bit about how those jets on Jupiter and Saturn relate to the cloud patterns that you will see in our images, or if you look through a telescope at either planet. On the left-hand side, we have the wind speed as a function of latitude for Jupiter, and the gray areas that are marked out are what we refer to as belts. Those are the places where the clouds are darker on Jupiter, and the white regions are the zones, and that's where the clouds are brighter. And you can see that on Jupiter, the colors and brightness of the banded cloud patterns match up quite well with the wind pattern, such that, for example, the westward jets tend to occur, let's say, in the northern hemisphere at the northern boundary of a belt, and then the eastward jets tend to occur at the northward boundary of a zone. And so there are different signs of the wind shear, the rate of change of wind with latitude in the belts and the zones, such that in the belts we have what we call cyclonic vorticity. That is a vorticity is a is basically a measure of how much something placed into a shear flow would rotate. So if you imagine a pinwheel put into a belt region on Jupiter, then that pinwheel in the northern hemisphere would rotate in a counterclockwise direction, whereas one put into a zone has what we call anti-cyclonic shear. It would rotate the other way in the clockwise direction, and the winds and wind shears match up very nicely with the cloud patterns on Jupiter. On the right, we have the same type of information for Saturn, where you can see a wind profile overlaying on an image of Saturn, and it's not the same on Saturn, and that is something we still do not understand. On Saturn, the westward jets seem to be more in the middle of bands that have similar color and characteristics to them. The eastward jets seem to be in the middle of much narrower bands that tend to be somewhat darker than the other broader bands are. And so it's a very different kind of configuration than we see on Jupiter. We're not sure to what extent that difference is due to the overlying tropospheric haze that's affecting our view, or whether that's telling us something more fundamental about the dynamics that's going on underneath, and that's one of the continuing issues that we'll be trying to deal with as we go forward in time. Another thing to point out, though, is that the jet locations on Saturn seem to be places where the atmosphere is a little bit more active than it is in other places. You can see, for example, in the big jet location near about minus 40 degrees latitude, the big westward jet, you can see a big, what later I'll try to argue is a convective disturbance there where the westward wind peaks. And then at slightly lower latitudes, at about, say, 27 degrees latitude, there's an eastward jet, and you can see that there are a number of bright features there as well. And so the jet centers seem to be places where interesting things are happening on Saturn. All right, let's go on to the next slide. All right, where do these jets come from, and why do they stay there and not change all the time? There have been a variety of ideas proposed over many, many decades, going back to just before when I was born in 1952, to try to explain what was going on there. And these are sort of the main ideas, and I'll try to at least review talk in some detail about the first three of them as we go into the coming slides. But early on, just before I was born, Hess and Panofsky, who were familiar with the emerging knowledge of Earth's circulation, tried to make an analogy between what they knew was going on the Earth and what they knew or what they thought might be going on the Jovian planets. And they assumed that there were cells of rising and sinking motion, just like we have in the tropics on Earth, and I'll show you that in a minute, and that as air drifted poleward in those cells, they would experience on the rotating Earth a Coriolis force, a force that would appear to deflect the air into the direction of the planet's rotation, and they proposed that that might be the thing that produced the eastward jets and going in the opposite direction, the westward jets on the Jovian planets. Later on, people came up with other ideas that there were instability processes, in particular something called baroclinic instability, which I mentioned earlier is the process that produces our low and high pressure centers in weather maps on Earth, that are instabilities that are due to the fact that it's warmer at low latitudes and cooler at high latitudes on the Earth, and that's why we get those low and high pressure centers, and that might have something to do with creating the jets. Recently, people have become very interested in the idea of thunderstorms on the Jovian planets, and that those thunderstorms might directly feed energy into creating the jets. All of those theories are what we call weather layer hypotheses. The Jovian planets are different from the terrestrial planets in being deep atmospheres rather than shallow atmospheres, and so you can look at the meteorology in two different ways. You can imagine that the entire depth of the molecular hydrogen atmospheres of the Jovian planets is intimately involved in the circulation, and that you have circulation cells that are essentially going through the entire depth of the atmosphere, and on a rotating planet, if you had that type of thing, it would take the form of cylinders that would be rotating around and would somehow pump momentum into the upper atmosphere. Or you could take the view that the deep atmosphere is nothing more than just kind of a bubbling sort of pot of water, although it's not water, it's molecular hydrogen, but like a slowly bubbling pot of water on the stove that does nothing more than just help move the heat up to the upper levels in the atmosphere. And then once you got to the upper levels in the atmosphere, that's where all the real action would be taking place to convert that energy into the weather phenomena that we see and produce the jet streams and the various vortices and storms and things like that that we observe in the images. And so there are these two different, fundamentally different schools of thought about how the Jovian planets work as to whether the interesting things are happening up near the top or whether the interesting things are happening all the way through to the bottom. All right, let's go on to the next slide. This is slide number 11. This shows you the old idea going back to 1951 about the analogy, the imagined analogy between the Jovian planets and Earth. We don't normally think of Earth as having banded cloud patterns, but here's a satellite image of the Earth, and you can see that if you squint a little bit, Earth really does have its own sort of banded cloudiness to it. There is a thin band of clouds near the equator that meteorologists call the intertropical convergence zone, and there are lots of thunderstorms all around the planet there. The places where those things tend to occur is where we have our rainforest, the Amazon basin, Central Africa, Southeast Asia, places like that. And then if you go to somewhat higher latitudes, what meteorologists call the subtropics in either hemisphere, then the clouds tend to clear out. The skies tend to generally be much clearer. You get very little rain there, and those are the parts of our planet that are deserts. Okay, and that is accompanied, if you look at the right-hand side of this figure and look at the schematic diagram here, this shows you sort of a cross-section through the atmosphere, sort of a vertical slice through the atmosphere at different latitudes. And this is the type of figure that you'll find in any meteorology textbook for the Earth. There is, in general, rising motion near the equator on Earth, and then up near the tropopause, the air encounters the stable stratosphere above and stops rising and begins drifting poleward, and then it begins to sink in the subtropics, and that creates an overturning circulation cell with then a return flow down near the ground that produces our trade winds, and those are called the Hadley cells on Earth, and those are associated with the tendency for bright cloudiness near the equator and little cloudiness and deserts in the subtropics. And that was the idea of Hess and Panofsky, that those things were the analog to the belts and to the zones and belts on Jupiter, that the equatorial cloud region would be like the zones on the Jovian planets, and the subtropical deserts would be like the belts on the Jovian planets. But Earth's circulation is actually a little more complicated than that. You see that poleward of the subtropics, we have another sort of banded cloud region, our mid-latitude storm tracks, where we get these spiral type of comma-shaped cloud forms that you're probably all familiar with, associated with our warm fronts and cold fronts and low-pressure centers and things like that. But you can see that they're organized all the way around the globe in latitude bands, in the mid-latitudes as well, in the storm tracks. And there is another circulation that is associated with those things that goes the other direction, called a feral cell. Okay, and remember that idea. It's a little bit harder to explain. We'll try to explain it, but we think that that actually is the one that has more relevance to the Jovian planets than the tropical Hadley cell does. Okay, if you go to slide number 12, this again is the old Hessen-Panofsky idea of why we have the eastward and westward jets on the Jovian planets and why we have the zones and belts. And so again, their idea now, this is an imagined cross-sectional cut through the Jovian atmospheres vertically. And if you look at the blue arrows, they imagined that warm air was rising, just as it does near Earth's equator. Warm air was rising in the zones, and as that warm air rises, it cools off, it condenses water, and it makes clouds, and clouds are bright, and that's why we have zones. And then when the air got to the top in the zones, it would start to drift in this diagram, let's say, northward from the zone toward the belt. That would be toward the left, and as it did, the rotation of the planet would give it a Coriolis force that would deflect it to the right, and that would create, as you can see in the red arrow, an eastward jet in between the zone and the belt region. And then in the belt region, just as in the Earth's subtropical deserts, the air would begin to sink and warm up, the clouds would clear out, you'd have lower cloud tops, and you would get darker colors in the belts than you got in the bright zones where the air was rising and forming clouds. And again, you would have one of these Hadley cell-type circulation systems. And so that's a proposition that we can begin to test if we have a way of determining whether air really rises in the zones, in the anticyclonic shear regions on the Jovian planets, and whether it's actually sinking in the belts. The hard thing is that we can't measure those vertical velocities exactly because they're much weaker than the east-west velocities. We can measure the eastward jets and the westward jets quite easily, but we can't directly measure the vertical velocities, and so we need to be a little clever about that. And the way we wind up doing that is we wind up looking for thunderstorms, because thunderstorms happen in places where the overall vertical motion of the air is upward and they're suppressed in places where the air is downward. So that gives us a motivation to try to look for thunderstorms on the Jovian planet. Okay, if you go to slide number 13, here is a completely different idea about what might be maintaining the jets on the Jovian planets. And the idea is that if you have eddies, any kind of a disturbance in the mean flow, and for this purpose, imagine that you have a disturbance in the mean flow that causes air initially to, let's say, move around in a circle, in a vortex-like motion, just like, again, the low and high pressure centers on Earth do that routinely. And so if you have air moving around in something like a circle, and then that eddy, that little disturbance in the flow, then moves into a region where there is a wind shear, a systematic change in the wind with latitudes. And in the figure in the picture, I have taken an example from a latitude where in the center of that image there is an eastward jet, so a maximum in the wind speed moving toward the east. And there are eddies, little disturbances on either side. And if you take this little circular eddy and you put it into this region of wind shear, then the wind shear is going to deform the eddy and stretch it out into a more elliptical form. It's going to tilt it. And that tilt is going to create a bias. And what the net result of that bias is going to be is that momentum is going to be transported by the eddy into the jet. That's a hard thing, I think, to imagine at first. People usually don't have a hard time imagining that air motions can transport heat. So, for example, we know in the United States that before a low-pressure center comes by, usually the wind is blowing from the south, and on a day like that, the temperature will be warmer than normal because the wind is carrying with it warm air from the south and bringing it up to the north. And then after the cold front goes by, the wind direction shifts and cold air comes down from Canada into whatever location we are at, and the temperature goes down. So I think we have an easy time imagining that air motions can move heat around. We also have an easy time imagining they can move humidity around. We know it gets more humid and less humid associated with these motions in front of and behind the fronts on Earth. People are less used to the idea that such motions can carry momentum with them as well, but they can. A good way to imagine that is imagine you're watching a baseball game and a ground ball is hit slowly to the right-hand side, and the second baseman has to charge in to pick up the ground ball and then throw back across his body to first in the other direction from the direction that he's moving. The second baseman, in order to actually get the ball to first base, has to correct for the fact that he's moving toward home plate and has to direct the ball a little bit to the left of where first base actually is, because once he lets go of the ball is going to maintain that component of the momentum toward the plate due to his own motion. And if he doesn't correct for that when he lets go of the ball, he'll find that the ball drifts away from first base to the right and he won't have made an accurate throw. That's just an example of how that ball, having been thrown away, carries with it whatever momentum it had been carrying in the direction that it had been moving. The same thing is true with air parcels moving in planetary atmospheres. Once these air parcels become tilted, as I've indicated in the diagram here, they've taken on these elliptical shapes, then if you follow the arrows, every time there is an arrow that is moving, let's say, toward the center of the jet, if you look at, for example, the three uppermost ellipses, then you'll see that on the half circle of their transit in which they're moving toward the center of the jet, they're also moving in the positive, the eastward direction, and therefore carrying faster than average momentum with them. And on their other half of their circuit, where the arrow is pointing the other way and they're moving in the opposite direction away from the jet, then they're carrying momentum that is slower than the average amount of momentum. And so they bring high momentum air in and they take low momentum air out. And in that way, they systematically transfer momentum into the center of the jet and help accelerate it to keep it moving. So that's another idea, and there are several different versions of that idea as to how it might happen. One version of the idea suggests that the eddies are formed by thunderstorms, and another version of the idea suggests that they're formed by this baroclinic instability, this low and high pressure center mechanism that exists in mid-latitudes on the Earth. We can get a clue that something like that is happening just by looking at the image, because you can see that the cloud features, if you look at the bright linear cloud features, you can see that they're all tilted in the direction, they produce this sort of chevron, V-shaped kind of structure that sort of is like the head of an arrow that's pointing toward the center of the jet, and that's usually a giveaway that this type of process is happening. But just the shape of the clouds itself doesn't actually tell us that that's really happening, and so we have to really go in and measure the wind speeds to see whether those types of relationships are really occurring. So let's go to the next slide, number 14, and we'll talk a little bit about how we do that. Well, first of all, we can't image Saturn all the time. There are lots of instruments on the Cassini orbiter, each with their own science goals, and each with a preferred location and distance from the planet to do their best observing. And so the figure on the left shows you the petals of the various Cassini orbits as they go around Saturn. And in time, the white ones at the bottom, so pointing toward the bottom, that I have the arrow saying 2004-5, those represent the early mission orbits, and then as time went on, the orbits drifted more so that the apoapses, the farthest distance from Saturn, would take place on the night side of the planet. Those are the green ones. And now we've moved back again over to the day side, so that in 2007, where the yellow ones are at the top of the page there, you can see that during that time period, the apoapses were far from Saturn on the day side rather than the night side, and the periapsis is very close to the planet. Again, Saturn is so big that what we want to do to images, we want to stand far away from it. That's different from many of the other instruments on Cassini that want to get right up close and see things in as much detail as they can. We want to stand far back from Saturn and see as much of the planet as we can. And so those two sets of orbits early in the mission 2004-2005, when our apoapses were on the day side of the planet, and by the way, we need to be on the day side of the planet because the images are reflected sunlight, so we have to be on the day side or else we can't do business. And so early in the mission 2004-2005 and just last year, 2007, we had those dayside apoapses, and that's when we've been doing most of our business. If you look on the right-hand side, this gives you an example of what we do near apoapsis. We put together a mosaic of individual images, and you can see them numbered 0 through 8. And so it's like a 3-by-3 array of individual images that allows us to build up a regional picture of what's going on Saturn at any given time. And we tried to take images at several different wavelengths. I mentioned that we use the near-infrared wavelengths a lot because they can see through the haze better than other filters do and allow us to get more detail in the cloud images. But at the same time, sometimes we want to know what's going on higher up, and so for those, we use images in filters that are right in the middle of a methane absorption band. And when you are observing Saturn in the middle of a methane absorption band, you can't see very deep because the sunlight, as it's coming into the planet's atmosphere, is being absorbed by the methane. And if you get too deep, it's all absorbed and none of it gets reflected back out. So in a methane absorption band filter, you only see sunlight that's reflected from high altitudes. And so by using those two different filters, we can see things going on at two different altitudes. All right, let's go on to slide 15. And this gives you an idea of exactly what we do. This shows you a little latitude-longitude strip from two different images, top and bottom, of the same region on the planet separated by one Saturn rotation. And the little rectangle in the middle identifies a little cloud feature, a little kind of innocuous, little bright thing that you see toward the right-hand side of that little rectangle, and that's the cloud feature that we've identified in the first image. And then we go to the second image and we try to find the same cloud feature in the second image. If we can find the same feature in the second image, then we note how far it's moved in the intervening approximately 10.5 hours, a little bit more than 10.5 hours. And if we know how far it's moved and how long a time interval that has occurred over, then we can derive a velocity from that distance over time. And if we're lucky, then that gives us an indication of what the wind speed was at that location and that time. In the early days, people used to do this manually. They would actually just look at images the way that we're doing, identify features visually, and then just try to find the feature in the second image using the eye-brain combination. These days, we do it in automated fashion on the computer by just having the computer cross-correlate regions in the first image with regions in the second image and look for the places that are most highly correlated to each other, and those then are our cloud tracked features that give us the wind speeds that we need to understand what's going on. And that's how we map the circulation on the Jovian planet. Now, what we're looking to do in particular is we're looking for places where the east-west wind and the north-south wind, which we call U prime and V prime, are moving faster than average in a particular north-south direction or slower than average in the opposite north-south direction. So we're looking to see whether those east-west and north-south winds are correlated or uncorrelated with each other. If they're uncorrelated with each other, then this eddy tilting mechanism that I was talking about a minute ago can't work. But if they are correlated with each other, then that's telling us that momentum is being transported in some direction. And depending on the sign of the correlation, it's either being transported into the jet and speeding it up, accelerating it, or it's being transported out of the jet and slowing it down, decelerating it. And on the right-hand side, we have a graph that shows how the correlation between the east-west and north-south wind speeds, how that varies systematically according to, on the y-axis, the shear of the latitudinal shear of the zonal wind. And the sense of that, you can see that there is a correlation, and the sense of that correlation is that in the upper right-hand quadrant, there is a flux, a transport of momentum toward the north in places where the wind itself is strengthening toward the north. In other words, moving into an eastward jet. And in the lower left-hand quadrant, we can see that the correlation is negative in places where the wind is decreasing with increasing latitude, which also then gives you a net transport of momentum into the jet. And so this idea of tilted eddies that have been distorted by the shear and are now systematically transporting momentum into the jet, seems to be something that is working on Saturn. Previously, during the Jupiter flyby, my ISS colleagues demonstrated that this was taking place on Jupiter as well, and so we now have evidence that on both Jupiter and Saturn this process seems to be happening, and the net result of that is that these eddies are essentially giving up their kinetic energy, and it's being converted into the kinetic energy of the jet, of the mean flow everywhere. And so that is the process that seems to be accelerating these jets at the cloud level. Okay, let's go on to number 16.
Sorry, question?
Yes.
Is this at more than one latitude?
Yes, this is at all the latitudes at which we have data. Now, this particular figure is from a paper that we published last year, and at that time, we had only been able to observe the southern hemisphere when we did that analysis. And so these results are southern hemisphere only. The other thing about Saturn is that I mentioned that it is less contrasty than Jupiter is, and in particular, in the eastward jet regions, there are very few contrasts. And I also mentioned that the southern hemisphere on Saturn right now is very hazy, and so we had a very difficult time making these measurements near the eastward jet. So the vast majority of what you see in that figure are from the shear regions and the westward jet regions, and not very much from the eastward jet regions. However, since then, with the 2007 images of the northern hemisphere, where the haze appears to be a lot thinner and we can see a lot more detail, we've been able to do a much better job with that, and we've made analogous plots for the northern hemisphere, where now we can make these measurements both in eastward and westward jets, and we're getting the same answer. So it does seem to be a pretty universal thing.
Okay,
slide number 16. This shows you a close-up of the most dramatic convective storm that we've detected to date. How do we know this is convection? Well, we don't. On Earth, there are things that we use to determine whether something is a thunderstorm or not. Obviously, we know that thunderstorms produce torrential rain most of the time near the ground, although that's not an absolute requirement. It doesn't always happen, but most of the time, thunderstorms produce torrential rain. We have no way of measuring rain on the Jovian planets with the instruments that we have, so we don't for a fact know that these things are making rain. Thunderstorms on Earth produce lightning, and on Jupiter, we were actually able to observe lightning associated with cloud patterns that we thought were convective storms. We've attempted to do the same thing on Saturn, but we have not been able to observe lightning directly, and we believe that that is associated with the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the water cloud on Saturn is buried at deeper levels than it is on Jupiter, because Saturn is a colder planet and the water condenses out at deeper levels. And so even if it's producing lightning, the lightning flashes just can't get out through the overlying thickness of cloud. Furthermore, you have the thicker haze, tropospheric hazes on Saturn than on Jupiter, and all of those things we believe are making it difficult for lightning to get out to places where we can detect it with our cameras. However, we have other ways of concluding that the things that we're looking at in this image are indeed convective storms of the kind that we have on Earth. First of all, one of the defining features of thunderstorms is that they are very tall. They're taller and thicker than other types of cloud patterns that we see on Earth, and the same thing is true on the Jovian planets. So we look, first of all, for things that are very bright compared to other cloud features, that is, that things that are reflecting a lot of sunlight, and we look for things whose tops are very high. And this is why we image Saturn both in a near-infrared filter that sees through the haze down to the deepest level that we're able to see in, and then we simultaneously take images of Saturn in a methane band absorption feature that is sensitive to clouds at very high altitudes. And by looking at those two things together, we can figure out the places where we have clouds at one altitude, clouds at another altitude, or thick clouds that are spanning the range of altitudes. And so the image that you're looking at here is a false color image that essentially marks how much sunlight is being reflected in the two different wavelengths simultaneously. And the false color, the way you interpret the false color is that in places where the image is blue, those are places where the image is bright in the methane band and dark in the near-infrared continuum band, and that means that you have a high cloud that is not very thick and deep. There are other places where just the opposite is true, where you have a low-level cloud that does not reflect much sunlight at high altitudes but does at low altitudes, and those places show up as pinkish or reddish. And then in the midst of that little cluster of things there in the middle of the image, you see a little region in the middle where it is a brighter white or yellowish color, and those are places where sunlight is being reflected both in the methane absorption filter, which tells us that the cloud top is high, and in the continuum filter, which tells us that the cloud is very thick and deep. And so that's how we identify a convective cloud. And that's not all that much different from the way that people do that on Earth as well. There are other pieces of information that suggest to us that this thing is a thunderstorm-type cloud. First of all, it is a small, rapidly evolving thing, and that doesn't happen too often on the Jovian planets. Most cloud features are bigger, and once they form, they last for a long time, but the convective clouds kind of come and go. They brighten, and then they go away, and so you can tell that they're different. And then finally, we got some help from another instrument on Cassini, the radio and plasma wave spectrometer experiment, which measures electrostatic discharges coming from Saturn. And what was noticed was that when this particular feature that we saw in our images, which came to be known as the Dragon Storm, when this appeared early in the mission, every time it would come into view as Saturn was rotating, and it would come over the horizon and come into view, the RPWS instrument would notice electrostatic discharges occurring, and then the thing would disappear over the other side, and the electrostatic charges would disappear. So the electrostatic discharges are presumably the signature of lightning, and the fact that their occurrence is correlated with the appearance of this Dragon Storm cloud feature in our images suggests to us that there really is lightning associated with this particular storm, even though we can't, in our images, actually see the lightning itself. Okay, let's go on to number 17, just to illustrate that that's not the only thunderstorm that we think we see on Jupiter. There are other places on Saturn. There are other places where we also see these small, bright cloud features that evolve quickly, and we believe that we're seeing these storms happening in a variety of places. And so what we are trying to do is to map them to try to understand where they occur and what that tells us. And if we go to slide number 18, you can see that on the left-hand side is a plot of the wind field that I showed you before. The zonal wind, the east-west wind, is a function of latitude. And in the middle, there is a bar graph showing you the number of convective storms that we've measured at each latitude. And don't worry about the difference between the black and the red. It's irrelevant for what we're going to talk about here. The one point I wanted to make is that if you look at where in latitude the thunderstorms are occurring, there are a lot of them that occur in the cyclonic wind shear regions. Those are the things that on Jupiter we would call belts. And there are relatively few of them occurring in the anticyclonic regions, which are the things on Jupiter we would call zones. On the right-hand side is a similar type of diagram for Jupiter itself, and you can see that the association with the belts and zones is even more dramatic on Jupiter than it is on Saturn. Partly that might just be because it's easier to observe these things on Jupiter. Partly it might be a real difference between the two planets. But the main message is that the convective features are mostly in the belts, and they're almost never in the zones. And if you go back to this old picture of why we have belts and zones on the Jovian planets. The old idea was that the zones are bright because they're the regions of rising motion, and the belts are dark because they're the regions of sinking motion. These observations are telling us that that's not true. It's just the opposite. All of the thunderstorms are happening in the belts, and very rarely do they seem to be happening in the zones. So apparently, because thunderstorms are associated with rising motion, the air on the Jovian planets is actually rising in the belts and is sinking in the zones instead. And so that old picture of how the circulation of Jupiter and Saturn and the maintenance of their jets works seems to be wrong.
Question?
Yes.
Could that be a selection effect?
We have tried our best to try to deal with that. And the way we do that is that you can't just tell by looking at the images, but if you start plotting the data, you can plot, as I say, we identify the convective features by simultaneously looking for things that are bright in this continuum filter that sees relatively deep, and in this methane band filter that sees cloud tops that are high. And so if you just make a scatter plot of how bright a particular region is in one wavelength versus how bright it is at another wavelength, if you do that in one of the regions that has a convective cloud, the convective cloud pixels stand out as an unusually bright area both in the methane band and in the continuum band. And so you can do that, you can see that very easily for the zones, for the belts, where everything else surrounding it is relatively dark. Then what we can do is we can go to the zones, where in general everything is brighter than it is in the belt, and we can ask, is there anything in the zones that is as bright as these brightest areas in the belts that we think are thunderstorms? And the answer is we see nothing in the zones, even though overall the zones are brighter than the belts are. The bright areas in the belts that we think are thunderstorms are brighter than anything we see anywhere in the zones. And so we're pretty convinced that the thunderstorms are almost exclusively happening in the belts, and we've pretty much convinced ourselves that it's not a selection effect.
So they couldn't be just obscured by these supposedly high clouds that form in the zones?
Not without having a signature, because those higher clouds that are forming in the zones would just add to the brightness of them. And so if they were being preferentially obscured by those, then you would see things, and then you would have basically something bright on top that was hiding something that was also bright underneath it, so that the total brightness of the column would be even higher than what we saw in the belts, where you didn't have the advantage of the extra stuff on top to reflect even more sunlight. So if that were the case, if it were being hidden by higher hazes, then we'd expect to see areas that were brighter than anything we would see in the belts. And instead, the brightest things we see in the belts are brighter than anything we see anywhere in the zones. And it's not foolproof. The other thing we can say, for Jupiter at least, where we can observe lightning, is that lightning is observed only in the belts, not in the zones. But that is something that could be a selection effect, because if you had thicker clouds that made it difficult for lightning to get out, then you might just be obscuring the lightning in the zones, and it would be easier for it to get out in the belts, and then you'd be seeing a latitudinal dependence that really was a selection effect. So we feel that although lightning is a more direct indicator that something really is a thunderstorm than just looking at the brightness and the height of cloud features, we feel that the fact that the brightest cloud features in the belts are brighter than anything we see anywhere in the zones is probably a more reliable indicator of something that is a real difference and not a selection effect. Okay, so going to slide number 20, this is just going back to the different ideas that I mentioned earlier about why we have the alternating jets on the Jovian planets. We've basically ruled out the old idea that you have rising motion in the zones and sinking motion in the belts like we have on the tropics of the Earth, and instead we seem to be coming toward a picture that is more like the mid-latitudes on the Earth, where eddies that may be like the low and high pressure centers that we see on our weather maps in mid-latitude on Earth get sheared out and tilted and they transport momentum into the jet from both sides. And associated with that is a circulation that is just the opposite of the one that was imagined 50 years ago, 60 years ago, namely that there's rising motion in the belts and sinking motion in the zones. There are these other ideas for how the eastward and westward jets might be driven. So people have suggested in recent years that the thunderstorms themselves are actually feeding their energy into the jets. We've looked for that, but we haven't been able to find good evidence of that. And I realized I skipped slide number 19, and that was an attempt actually to test this particular mechanism. Slide number 19 that says no sign of preferred drift direction or concentration of large momentum fluxes. Basically what we did was we went into the images and looked at what these momentum fluxes were near where the convective storms were, and we looked to see whether the convective eddies systematically drifted toward the jets, which would be a requirement for them to be dumping their energy into the jets, and basically we saw no evidence that that was happening. And so we can't rule that out, but we've yet to see any evidence that suggests that that is a viable hypothesis for actually making jets. There have been numerical simulations to try to produce that effect, and different people get conflicting results. There was a study done by one of the members on our team that was able to make that process happen in a numerical model, and then there was another study by someone else, Adam Shoman and his colleague at the University of Arizona, that was not able to make that process happen. And so it can't be ruled out yet, but it doesn't look like it's as viable an idea as the one that is more analogous to the normal process that goes on in mid-latitudes on the Earth. Then there's this other theory of the deep convective cylinders, a circulation that goes all the way down to the base of the molecular hydrogen layer. There are recent numerical simulations that are making people think that that might be a relevant process, especially at low latitudes where the strong equatorial jet is driven on Saturn. It's not obvious yet from those simulations what you would observe at the cloud top to help you decide whether that theory was correct or not correct, but it still must be considered a viable theory. All right, let's go on to slide number 21, and this now is kind of summarizing the shift in our view of what we're seeing when we're looking at the Jovian planets. This is a repetition of what I showed before, the old view in which the rising was in the zones, the sinking was in the belts, and the analogy was to Earth's tropics and the Hadley cell. And then if you click to slide 22, now in the red, you see this mid-latitude circulation that goes the other way, that's associated with the mid-latitude low and high pressure centers, in which the upwelling is actually occurring in the belts and the sinking is in the zones, and we think that's actually the better analogy. So we think that the Jovian planets may indeed be like Earth, but like a different part of the Earth than what has been imagined for most of our history of thinking about the Jovian planets.
But question, how does that relate to the colors then? This traditional idea of the white stuff is condensate. So that no longer works, I guess.
Right, so that no longer works, and I can give you half an answer to that question and not the other half an answer. The other half we're still trying to figure out. So the way the first half works, the easier part to understand is the belts. Okay, if you look at the Earth and you look at where air is moving upward on Earth, where we have thunderstorms, for example, near the equator, actually the equatorial band of clouds, the intertropical convergence zone on the Earth, is a place that is really a study in contrast. You have a small number of places where you have these torrentially raining storms throwing off cirrus clouds, anvils at the top that reflect a lot of sunlight, and then in between those clouds, every place else, the air is sinking and it clears out and you have clear skies. So on the Jovian planets, where you don't need nearly as many thunderstorms in order to get the heat out from the center of the planet as you do on the Earth, you have the occasional thunderstorm that comes by every once in a while that makes the belt very bright in one particular location. Like if I were to take you back to to slide number 17, where I just had some sample images of convective storms on Saturn. You can see there are a few individual places where it'll get very bright, and then every place else it will be darker because the air is sinking every place else. And so we believe then that the belts are dark because the convective storms that are occurring in the belts are actually occurring over a very small area. They're carrying all the mass and all the heat that needs to get out from the interior of the planet, but all of that is happening concentrated in very small areas, and every place else there is a gentle sinking motion that actually causes clouds to dissipate and cloud tops to lower, and that's why the belts are darker. That by itself then does not explain why the zones are bright. I have an idea about that, and I have no idea whether it is a viable idea or not. There are places in the subsiding regions of the Earth's subtropics that are not cloud-free. In particular, since this telecon is being run out of JPL, if you head west from Pasadena out to the coast, especially on a summer morning, most of the time you'll find, or a lot of the time at least, you'll find that it's cloudy in the morning near the coast. And as you go out over the Pacific Ocean, and there is what we call a marine stratocumulus cloud deck there that is actually fairly persistent. It tends to go away in the afternoon a lot of the time because the sun heats it, but not all the time. And the farther north you go in California, the more persistent it is. So perhaps different kinds of clouds like that are a better analogy for what's going on in the zones on the Jovian planet. But at this point, we just do not know, and that's something that remains to be understood.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, if we go to slide number 23, this is just sort of a summary, sort of a cross-section of what you might imagine that we're seeing on the Jovian planets. And this figure, Z is the vertical direction and Y is the latitudinal direction, let's say pointing toward the North Pole, for example. And this figure is actually not something I took from a paper on Saturn or Jupiter, but it's a paper I took from a review article about Earth meteorology in mid-latitudes. And it's showing what goes on there, and really we think that what's going on Saturn and Jupiter is actually quite analogous. We think that there are these baroclinic storms, these storms that are trying to transport heat poleward and upward like we have on Earth, that are down beneath the level mostly that we can see in our images, and they are generating a circulation in which air is rising at higher latitudes and sinking in lower latitudes, and up near the level that we can see in our images, around 1 to 2 bar pressure, then there are these eddy momentum fluxes, U prime, V prime, that are pumping momentum into the jet, and the Coriolis force on this mean circulation that is going around in the opposite direction is actually opposing that, and the balance between those two forces is what's keeping the jets stable over a long period of time. Okay, just in the last couple of minutes, I know you all want to get going, I just thought I would talk about a couple of regional features that people might be interested in. First, at the equator, these are in slide number 24, these are three different images of Saturn taken at three widely spaced times. On the left, we have a Voyager image back from 1981 when there was a relatively quiescent character to the equatorial region on Saturn. Then in the upper right-hand corner, we know that in the 1990s, all hell broke loose in the equatorial region. We started to get eruptions of these apparently very vigorous thunderstorms. It began in 1990 with the so-called Great White Spot. This is a Hubble Space Telescope image taken from a few years later, 1994, when there was another outbreak of these clouds, and you can see right in the middle of that image, just above the rings, you can see an outbreak of what looks to be a very vigorous convective storm near Saturn's equator. Now, at the bottom right, you see what Saturn looks like during the Cassini era, and it looks a lot more visually like it did at the time of Voyager than during most of the time that Hubble was imaging Saturn in the 1990s, with one big difference, and that is when we go in and look more closely at that equatorial region, the cloud tops are a lot higher now than they were back at the time of Voyager. If you go to slide number 25, on the left is a repeat of that latitudinal profile of the east-west winds that I've shown you several times before, but now I want to talk about what all those different colors mean. Those colors tell us how the wind profile has varied with time from different missions that people have used to make measurements. So the solid dark line is the Voyager wind profile from 1980-1981. And the orange circles represent wind measurements that were done by Sanchez La Vega's group in Spain from Hubble Space Telescope images. And you can see that at most latitudes, the orange circles line up very nicely with the Voyager wind profile that's given by the dark line. But when you get closer to the equator than about 15 degrees latitude in either hemisphere, all of a sudden the Hubble data start to disagree a lot with the Voyager data. The wind speeds are dramatically lower near the equator during the Hubble era than during the Voyager era. The green and the red symbols are measurements, and the blue symbols, are measurements that we have made from Cassini in recent years. The green and red symbols are measurements made in our continuum filter. And the only difference between the green and the red is that the measurements were made manually by two different people working independently just as a kind of a sanity check to make sure one person wasn't biased in getting answers that were systematically different just because of the way they were looking at the images and choosing things to track. So we had two different people on opposite sides of the country take images and try to measure wind speeds. And they got the same results, which is a nice thing. And those results are stronger than the wind speeds near the equator that Hubble got, but weaker than the wind speeds that Voyager got. And so the question is, have the wind speeds really changed? And if they have really changed by that much, it's a very dramatic change. It's a change of over 100 meters per second, a change of several hundred miles per hour. And to imagine that wind speeds could actually change that much on these huge planets is a very difficult thing to swallow. And so we've thought about other explanations for why that might be happening. And it goes back to the change in the visual appearance of these planets, namely that once the storms broke out in the 1990s, as seen by Hubble, the cloud tops in the equatorial region started to come up. And now during the Cassini era, even though the equatorial region doesn't seem to be quite as active as it was during the time of Hubble, the cloud tops still appear to be very high. And the thing about remote sensing, imaging of atmospheres, is that you can only see down as high as the clouds themselves are. And so if the cloud tops have shifted upward, the region that you're the altitude at which you're measuring the winds is going to be different from the altitude at which you were measuring the winds when the cloud tops were lower. And so the question is, do the winds vary vertically, and could that be giving us an impression of weaker winds when instead we're just measuring the winds at a different altitude? And so on the right-hand side, another experiment, the infrared experiment, SEERS on Cassini, measures temperatures above the clouds, and from the temperature patterns you can deduce what the wind field looks like using something called the thermal wind equation of meteorology that basically says if the temperature is getting colder toward the pole, the wind speed should increase with height, and if the temperature is getting warmer toward the pole, the wind speed should decrease with height. Well, above the clouds, the temperatures generally decrease with latitude in places where the wind is westward and increase with latitude in places where the wind is eastward, and that gives you a systematic decay of the wind speeds with increasing height above the clouds. And so one possible idea that would explain this apparent change of the equatorial region is that the winds haven't changed at all, but we're now looking at a higher altitude where the winds are just weaker. In support of that, we made other measurements with our methane band images, which we know see to higher altitudes than the continuum band images do, and those were represented by the blue squares on the plot on the left. And you can see that our measurements in the methane band images match up nicely with the Hubble Space Telescope measurements, lower speeds. And so we do think that a large part of what we've seen going from the Voyager to the Hubble to the Cassini era might just be an artifact of the fact that the clouds have come up higher during this particularly stormy epoch on Saturn, and that now is causing us to just measure winds at higher altitudes where the winds are weaker. However, there are numerical models, one that was published by Sayanagi and Shoman just last year, that showed that if you have convective storms, you really can expect the winds to get weaker. And so there is a decent chance that what's going on Saturn is some real combination of the fact that we're looking at a higher altitude and a fact that the storminess that we've seen in the equatorial regions has actually caused the winds to decrease over time. And then the last thing I want to talk about, if we move to slide 26, is what's going on near the South Pole on Saturn, which has gotten a lot of attention. This is a polar projected mosaic of images on the left-hand side looking down at the South Pole, and this is another one of these false color composites of several different filters. And so where you're seeing the reds and pinks, those are where the skies are relatively clear and you're seeing down to relatively deep into the atmosphere, clouds with low tops, and the places where you're seeing the bluer colors are places where you're seeing higher tops, and the places that are the brightest are places where we think we have high, thick, convective-type clouds, as I was talking about before. And there is this very unusual-looking feature surrounding the South Pole of Saturn, an apparent vortex that has an inner ring of very bright, high clouds, and then an outer ring of more high clouds. And if you look at the lower three black and white images there, labeled B, C, and D, one of the ways that we know for sure that that ring of clouds surrounding the central core there are high cloud tops is that at these latitudes you get the sun casting a distinct shadow. And so if you have very high cloud tops, then you can notice that they're high by noticing the shadow cast by the sun. And so the little arrows, the one on the top in B and the one extending from the C inward in the middle one and the one on the left, the arrow on the left-hand side in image D, you can see as a function of time how the sun's shadow is moving around. You can see the little dark area inside that ring of bright clouds, and it's moving around with the sun, and that's telling us that that's a real shadow and that those are high clouds surrounding this inner core. And on the right-hand side, you see an image of Hurricane Katrina on Earth, and that's exactly the type of structure that we see near the center of a hurricane. There is a central eye in which clouds are either low or absent, and then that's surrounded by an eye wall of very high, thick, heavily precipitating clouds and very strong winds, and that's where most of the damage from a hurricane comes from. We know that hurricanes have these spiral bands extending out from the center. If you look at the Cassini images, you can even see a couple of very weak spiral bands extending out from the center here. So that's made people think, well, maybe this is something like a terrestrial hurricane. And if we move to slide 27, here's the evidence pro and con. On the right upper hand is the thermal image associated with a terrestrial hurricane, and the purples and reds represent cold temperatures, and the greens represent warm temperatures, and you can see in the eye the hurricane is warm. It's a so-called warm core system. On the left, you can see the Cassini temperatures as derived from Sears data, and you can see it's also relatively warm in the center, and so that's a feature that it has in common with hurricanes. Below that, you can see wind profiles going from the outside to the center of the system. Unfortunately, the Cassini one on the left, the outside to the center goes from left to right, and the one for a terrestrial hurricane on the right, outside goes from right to left. So you have to flip them in your mind's eye. But you can see in both cases, as you go toward the center of the hurricane, the winds increase and peak near the eye wall, and then they get very weak in the interior. So all of those things make us think that it has something to do with terrestrial hurricanes. There's just one big problem. We know now where terrestrial hurricanes come from, and we know that the one ingredient that you really need to make a hurricane on Earth is that you need warm ocean waters underneath, and those things provide the energy source. As you get strong winds whipping up near the ocean surface, That causes water to evaporate from the ocean surface. That water that evaporates from the ocean surface is what goes up inside the clouds in the eye wall and releases latent heat, and that's what drives the hurricane, gives it its energy source. Well, on Saturn, there is no ocean underneath us. And so if this thing is to be related to a hurricane, there is this huge question of where does it get its energy from. There are other things that make it unlike a hurricane. Unlike hurricanes, which move around and propagate, the Saturn vortex is fixed to the South Pole. It looks like it might be long-lived rather than a very transient feature. And so all of those things make us think that although morphologically it shares something in common with hurricanes on Earth, really when it comes down to why it exists and what it is, probably it's something else. What that something else is and why it's there, why we don't have one at the North Pole, why we don't have one at the South Pole on Jupiter and so on, we don't know the answers to any of those questions yet. So finally, I've gotten to the last slide here, which is just a summary of what we've been talking about, that our current understanding of both Saturn and Jupiter is that their circulation may, in fact, be analogous to Earth, but not to Earth's tropics, instead Earth's middle latitudes. For Saturn in particular, the relationship between the winds and the albedos, the brightness of the cloud bands, is something we have yet to understand. There have been dramatic changes near the equator. Maybe some dramatic changes in the winds, but we need to look at that more strongly. A big question is, whatever is changing at the equator, why is it changing? And one of the big differences between Saturn and Jupiter is that Saturn axis is tilted to a much greater extent, 26.7 degrees compared to Jupiter, which is just a little bit over 3 degrees. And so Saturn has a much stronger seasonal cycle. And so perhaps something having to do with the progression of the seasons on Saturn, maybe involving shading by the rings, is creating a tendency for storms to occur near the equator preferentially during certain seasons, but that's something that's yet to be understood. And finally, the South Polar Vortex that we see on Saturn does share some characteristics in common with hurricanes on Earth, but we think it's probably not really the same kind of animal. Okay, thank you for your patience in listening to me today.
Thank you very much, Tony. Does anybody have any questions?
I was wondering if the Saturn gets warmer as you go down, so could the liquid hydrogen area act like an ocean underneath?
Probably not, because that is really, really deep. Of course, we don't know how deep any of these features actually go, but the other thing about it is that the hydrogen, what you need is for a phase change to occur that is tied in to the winds themselves. So on Earth, the relevant constituent is water, which exists in liquid form, and then when strong winds come along and bring dry air into contact with the wet ocean surface, that causes water to evaporate. On the Jovian planets, although you eventually get down beneath a molecular hydrogen region to a zone in which you have this metallic, kind of more liquidy hydrogen, that's a different kind of phase change, and it's not obvious that, first of all, these things would extend down that far. Certainly the water clouds associated with what we see in the images aren't extending down anywhere near that far, and what kind of interaction there might be at great depths between any residual wind motions and that phase change at greater depths is harder to understand, and why it would happen just in that location, as opposed to the things we see on Earth, which originate primarily in the tropics as isolated vortices and then go propagating off somewhere. That's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing seems to be sort of a more fixed feature of the general circulation, so I'd say probably not.
Any other questions? Well, Tony, would really like to thank you for this presentation. I thought it was just awesome. And, the Earth-Saturn analogies are things that a lot of our volunteers and museums will probably like to incorporate in some of their programs, because that's always kind of a popular and friendly topic to compare our planets to Earth. So thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
And with that, I'll conclude the telecon. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye, thank you.
Tony, you still on?
Jane's still on. I don't know if Tony's still on.
Oh, no, this is Jeff. I just had another question for Tony. I didn't want to take up the time. I'll just send him an email. Thanks.